Welcome to Wild Hearts at Work, a podcast redefining our relationship with work through stories and conversations with wild hearts who have dared to challenge the status quo. And now, here's your host, Melissa Boggs.
Hello, friends, and welcome back to the Wild Hearts at Work podcast. This is your host, Melissa Boggs, and this week, my guest is transformational coach Elise Shapiro. Elise is an ORSC coach, a CTI coach, and a certified team coach with Scrum Alliance. Before I introduce her to the show, I just want to share a quote from her LinkedIn recommendations because it literally like made me smile and blew my mind. 10 years ago, someone literally said, Elise is transforming our company. So this was the type of person I wanted to have on the podcast. Elise, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Way to just like embarrass you as soon as you get on the show and say all the wonderful things about you, huh?
Yeah. Like, what are you quoting? What's going on here?
So for the listeners, Elise and I were on an agile coaching call last week, and we're talking about some of the intersections between the agile values and principles and TEAL, for those who are familiar with Lulu. And Elise just had so many cool stories and stories about, as you put it, distributing management and organizations that were working without managers. And so we're kind of flying blind into this episode, but I just know that you have so many cool stories. So, you know, I have some questions for you. We don't know exactly what we're going to talk about, but that's what people with wild hearts do.
It'll be exciting. Whatever just, happens, it's going to be exciting.
They do. We just fly right into it.
Yeah.
So let's start with this idea of distributed management. When we were chatting before we started recording, you were kind of explaining some of your experience with that. So just tell me a little bit about what that means.
Yeah. So the functions of management are actually really important. But the traditional way of working in which like you have a manager, like every team has a manager, isn't necessarily, I think, the best way to accomplish stuff. If you actually think about the pieces of management, like you have to be able to budget, hire, fire, coach people. Sometimes you distribute work. Like there's all kinds of different things. You might create like structures and programs for people. You are approving expense reports, like all kinds of stuff. It's kind of a grab bag of things. And I've rarely met a single person who likes to do all of that stuff, right? So when I look at performing the functions of management, I've always been interested in, you know, how can we actually break apart those functions and send them to people who want to do them, who have an interest, or who want to learn how to do a certain function?
Yeah.
So I've always been interested in that. And then I've been in a couple companies where we've tried and done that in different ways, some by accident and some on purpose.
I love that. We've accidentally stumbled into no managers. Yeah, I get that though. Real quick, before you go a little bit further into that, what struck me when you were describing that is what I think we've all experienced is that not only is it rare to find someone who actually wants to do all of those things, it's rare to find someone who's good at all of those things. And also, even if that person was perfect, you're concentrating a lot of really important functions into a single bottleneck.
Yes.
And so I think what you're about to describe and the idea of all of those things being distributed sort of opens the world up to where everything's not backing up at one person, all of these approvals. I'm using air quotes here. Is that what you have seen? And is that what you've seen sort of relieved by this notion?
I have seen that in some instances where things do get bottlenecked on a single person. And even in the places where we haven't had line level managers, I actually then see things get bottlenecked on VPs or CTOs.
Oh, sure.
In cases where the responsibility hasn't been found out and broadened out in a reasonable way. So even in those situations, you can get into a bit of a jam if the VP has to approve all kinds of stuff. But I've also seen a lot of unskilled managers, I'll say. And I've seen a lot of people who have felt like there's just a single person who has undue influence on their career. Because they have a line level manager and they don't get on for whatever reason, right? They don't have a good relationship. And so eliminating managers and bringing in different structures to do performance valuations and things like that can actually help make sure that there's a more holistic and rounded view of each human in the system for things like that.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And different perspectives. Yeah. For that person.
Yeah.
So what kind of organizations have you seen, first of all, even try this, and second of all, you know, be conducive to it?
Well, I tend to work in startups. So the bulk of my career is in sort of venture-funded tech startups and some non-venture-funded tech startups. So when you're in a startup, the first thing you do is generally not hire a bunch of managers. You generally hire a bunch of engineers and everyone just reports to the VP. And that's really, really common. And so I enter into a lot of organizations that don't have a large hierarchy or management structure. And you know, then sort of my goal is, hey, how long can we run this way before people feel like there needs to be a hierarchy? And if people do show up, I've been in a situation many times where I've been in a room and people are like, well, we need to hire managers now. And I'm like, okay, what need are you filling with that? What isn't happening that should be happening? And our managers are the only way to do that, right? In some cases, Sure, that the answer is yeah, hire managers. And in some cases, well, the things that you want to happen can happen in a multitude of other ways. So let's actually look at what are different ways we could accomplish that goal.
I think what I love about that is regardless of the outcome of that question, it makes all of those functions, responsibilities, needs, problems explicit.
Yes.
You know, I mean, even if you end up in the, yeah, okay, maybe we have to hire a manager. Now all of those things are explicit and maybe they don't all end up with the manager. You know, maybe you end up in sort of like a partial distribution there. Cool. So what does happen like when you have those conversations and you're able to delay it a little bit?
So at the last company that I worked at, we delayed having a manager. They even still don't have like line level managers for the teams. They have directors now. That manage across 3 to 6 teams, and the team members directly report to them. But for a long time, we had directors and nobody reported to them. And what we did there, so that company ran for about, I want to say, a good 8 years without having technical employees within engineering report to anyone outside of like the VP or the one of the founders. So what we did there was we created a lot of structures and roles. So we had an advisor program that actually predated me. It was set up by an engineer and one of the founders, where engineers would be matched with an advisor and they would do one-on-ones, right? And we grew that program over the years. We gave the advisor population quite a lot of training, coaching training, mentoring training, to help sort of up-level them and help them understand how to actually do career coaching with folks, how to actually have productive conversations. So that's like one structure that we implemented. We also implemented a mentoring program, which was more of a targeted program, like, hey, I want to learn a skill. Okay, great. We're going to match you with someone who's can mentor you in that. And those relationships were like, you know, 4 to 6 months long. And there would be, you know, some skill the person wanted to learn. We encouraged folks to give homework, you know, all kinds of stuff like that. And so we would, you know, match you to a mentor. So that was another structure that we created. We did, And we did a number of other things. So, you know, one of the big questions that we would always get is what happens when someone is a poor performer or isn't performing right as they should? Mm-hmm. Isn't that like a total nightmare if you don't have managers? And so we actually created structures for that as well. So all of our teams had coaches. So we all had, we had agile coaches that would cover, we had quite a lot of teams that we were covering. So most agile coaches had 4 to 7 teams. Mm. But as agile coaches, we also did one-on-ones with our team members. And so we were often the first person who would really start to understand if there was a performance problem on a team. And so, you know, if we got complaints from team members about somebody, we'd look into it and kind of see, hey, is this just two folks not getting along with each other, or is there a real problem here? And then if there was, we would talk to the VP or one of the directors and let them know. We'd try to resolve the issue just at the team level if possible. But we did come up with a PIP plan, which basically involved a senior engineer who was on the team, either a director or the VP, whoever was the right person in leadership who was sort of closest to that individual or that team, and the agile coach and someone from HR. So we had like a little team surrounding a person who wasn't performing well, right? And then that person could create a plan and they could work their plan and they would either resolve their issues or they wouldn't. But what was really nice about that is that it was like a little cohort of people who are kind of looking at that performance from multiple different angles and aspects and levels. So it's not like a single person is like, hey, I don't like you, I'm just going to fire you.
Right.
You know, it was more of a sort of a group activity. And so I think that was really nice in terms of helping people feel a little safer in their careers. And also because they had a coach supporting them, you know, we're always in your corner. Right. We're always, as a coach, we're always there with you, hoping for you to succeed and trying to support you in succeeding. Right. So you always had someone who was on your side. And I think that's actually really important for people, especially when they're having troubles. Because, you know, you can have someone who was a high performer, something happened in their personal life, and then suddenly they're not doing all the right stuff at work anymore. But it's a temporary dip. It's not a permanent thing. Right. And so having support, having coaching, I think is really important in those situations.
Sure. Yeah, definitely. And the idea that coach is, they're in your corner, but they're not the single person who holds your career in their hand, you know, feels like it would give that person actually a little more feeling of responsibility over their own career, which is obviously awesome. I'm curious and related, but what did you all do, or what ideas do you have, even if you haven't tried it yet, around things like performance reviews or like performance feedback when you don't have a manager?
Yeah. So we did two feedback cycles a year at that company. That was the cadence. At that company, they always did 360 feedback from the very beginning, even before they actually even had a formal like review process. So folks were in the habit of doing 360. So we would do the 360 peer review twice a year. And then there was also a contribution review where we would look at sort of how are you contributing to the business, right? At what level are you contributing? And over the years, you know, the company did what companies do, which is they created leveling docs, which is like, this is a level one engineer, this is a level two engineer, et cetera. So there's a, you know, the big grid with all the competencies and all that stuff. And so, you know, we would do a data gathering exercise and sort of try and figure out, you know, what features had this person contributed to, what cross org or extracurriculars did they contribute to? Are they leading any efforts? Are they, you know, expert in any area? Things like that. So we would try and get a pretty holistic view of the person's contribution in the past 6 months. And then we would get a fairly large group of people together in a room. So over the years, the group of people who participated in the contribution reviews actually broadened out quite a bit. So, you know, in the beginning, it was just like the founder and like a couple of key engineers. And then right before I left, you know, it was the founder, it was the VP, it was the directors, it was all the agile coaches, it was all the most senior tier of engineers, and then some engineers who were like right below that level who were leading teams that didn't have a principal engineer on them. And so, you know, you can imagine we had like quite a lot of people there, and all those people see the human we're talking about from all these different angles and see what that person contributes from all these different angles. And together we would try and figure out, had that person moved up a level or not? And then the pay scale of that company was particularly tied to level. So a lot of bias was not in the system that you might find at other companies where they don't have pay pegged to level, where you could get a gender bias or all kinds of biases in the system. In that particular system, as long as we could see you well and could level you well, you would get the same pay as the next person who had that same level as well, which was really nice.
Yeah, so. I love that. At a previous company where I worked, we had a similar notion. But one thing that they tried that was really cool was that you actually pitched what you thought your levels were in these different competencies. Mm-hmm. And you had to defend it almost like a thesis, not in a defensive way, right? But the same way that you would defend a thesis. And then you would get this feedback. And what was so cool about that is I remember the very first person who did it, because it was very much an experiment when I was there. The very first person who did it underrated himself, because this wasn't like level one, level two engineer. This was like, here's 10 competencies. Here's where you think you are with each one of them. And yes, there was like one or two where people said, hey, maybe you could work on this. I don't know if I agree you're quite here. But there were like several where people were saying, you're crazy. Like, you're well beyond the level that you know, that you're giving yourself. And what I loved about that was like this communal, and I hear it in your example too, like this communal support of that person. And, yeah. And the support can show up in, hey, you need help with this, but we're here to help. Here's the, like you said, the advisor, the mentor, like here are these other programs that are all connected to it. So I love that. Like, I love the sort of idea of group performance feedback, as long as it's structured well, like you said, to, you know, to weed out the bias, to bring in as many perspectives as are appropriate. So that's really cool.
Yeah, it was great.
So at this org or other orgs, I presume that you've tried and led, you know, a bunch of different types of things, right? Again, one of the reasons I was so excited to have you on is, frankly, like, you have wild heart all over you, you know, like you have, we don't do things just because they're the way we've always done things, right?
Yeah, I just do crazy stuff all the time. All the time, yeah. With the crazy stuff. Yes.
So awesome. So my question for you is, do you have a story about a time when you were 100% uncertain that something was going to work out, but then it absolutely did work out?
That's pretty much like my everyday at work, I would say. So I'm constantly just trying new stuff that I have no idea if it's going to work or not. I think there was two things that I did at my last company very early on. One thing I did about a month after I showed up, which was I orchestrated a team self-selection process. So that was an interesting situation, because like I show up at this company, I've just been hired. I have my first sort of meeting with the VP, and the VP says to me, hey, I want to do a reorg in January. And I'm like, okay, why? And he says, well, the teams are not self-organizing enough. And I'm like, okay, sounds good. Let's not waste a good reorg. So, right. As most agile folks will know, that the more other people organize teams and individuals, the less they will self-organize. And so that's kind of not obvious if you're not used to working in that type of a system. And so I was like, well, okay, he wants to do reorg. Let me pitch a self-selection process for this reorg, because that will sort of kickstart and bootstrap the self-organization by choosing the team that you're going to be on. So I pitched it to the VP, I pitched it to the team leads. Everyone was super excited about it. And so we created, one of the things that I learned is that you have to have choice within constraints. You can't just have choice like, hey, do whatever you want. That almost never works out well. Right. And you also don't want like, hey, you go stand on that little square and do this little thing. That also is like a bit soul crushing. Right. Mm-hmm. So one of my mantras is have choice within constraints. So we set up constraints around these teams. We, you know, said this many teams, these are the work streams the teams are going to have. We gave each team a lead and a product person. They actually pitched their teams to the population. Right. So we had a session where they were like, come join my team. This is what we're working on.
I love that.
Which was really fun. And then we also were like, hey, each team can only have like no more than three folks who are, you know, 3 years or less out of college. So basically only like three juniors. So we wanted, you know, junior, mid, seniors on a team. We wanted them to be balanced. And then we had team sizes, and then we let the folks sort of select into their teams. And they almost followed the rules. They almost followed the rules, but they did not.
Oh boy. Okay.
And so all the, you know, leadership and the team leads, we all got into a room and they're like, they didn't follow the rules. Like, we have to go move them around. And I was like, well, why don't you just go back to the population and say, this is the thing that didn't follow the rules. So work it out. And strangely, they took my advice and they did that. And they were pleasantly surprised that it got worked out by the individuals involved. So that was really fun. And the most interesting thing is that, you know, when we looked at the teams that were formed, I remember super clearly, they're like, this one team is going to be so good. It's got like the best engineers on it. And there was this other team and they're like, yeah, we don't know about that one. We don't know. We don't think it's going to go well. And I was like, well, let's just let them do their thing. See how it goes. It turns out the team that everyone thought was going to be amazing was not so hot. And the team that people were like, ho-hum about ended up being really, really, really good team.
It's always so funny that way. Yeah. We think we know so much, you know, especially, and I can say this, you know, being someone who like has had, you know, a number of executive titles at this point, I think I know so much.
You don't?
But luckily, because of my agile background, you know, I try to set aside my, I think I know so much, you know, from time to time. I have to share quickly. So we did something similar at Scrum Alliance, right? We allowed teams to self-select and had a similar situation where, so there was one team in particular, one potential team, let me put it that way, like up on the wall, that it seemed like nobody wanted to put their name on. And I couldn't figure it out because like that particular topic or persona that that team was going to be focused on was actually really cool, but it was relatively greenfield. Mm. That particular persona did not have like a lot of products attached to it or a lot of community attached to it. They were going to have to kind of start from scratch. And so we were having a hard time in the workshop getting people to put their name on that team, right? And so eventually people did. And that team, within a very short amount of time, was easily the highest performing team in the company. And I took them to lunch, probably 8 weeks, maybe 10, and said, what is going on? Like, why are you guys so good? I'm so happy. But like, how do I help the other teams be this good? And, you know, like over the course of lunch, we talked and they didn't have an immediate answer. But what we finally figured out was the people who finally just sort of went, oh, what the hell? I'll put my name over there. Were the same people who would then go, oh, what the hell? Let's try this experiment. What can it hurt? You know, and we literally ended up with an entire team of people who were so open and willing to experiment and be vulnerable. And that's what made them high performing, because they weren't just willing to experiment with their product, but with how they worked as a team, you know. And so it's incredible. I really hope that more and more companies kind of keen into this idea and like understand how powerful it can be. I'm literally actually working with a client right now and we're having these conversations about, you know, whether they want to try this or not. And so you've actually given me a little bit of inspiration. But yeah,
I really believe in autonomy and agency for people at work. And I think that that's unfortunately still a radical idea. But I do find that people are more engaged and interested when they can direct what they're working on and who they're working with. You know, when they feel some sort of connection with the products they're making. And I don't think that's mainstream yet. And that's a little bit sad to me.
Yep. I think it's also powerful to the customers when and if they become aware. So another thing that came out of Scrum Alliance was there was one team in particular that when their customers learned that they chose them, like, you know, these were, again, persona-based teams, not product teams, but, you know, we chose them to, you know, you're the people I want to serve. Like, that was actually really powerful to the customer. And I think that same thing could be true of products as well. Like if I'm, you know, a customer consuming a product and I'm like, oh, you mean they had a choice and this was the one that they chose?
Yeah.
Well, I'm even more excited about using this product and what they're going to bring to me in the future, which means I want to stay, you know, subscribed or engaged or whatever it is with that product because they chose it. There's got to be something cool there.
Yeah, and we encourage those teams to talk to customers directly whenever possible. So, you know, in certain cases, the engineers got quite a lot of face time with actual real people using the product, right? And that's so motivating. Knowing that you're building something that really helps someone else's life, it's really, really motivating.
It really is. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. So you kind of alluded to this a little bit about autonomy and agency. With that, what else do you think that the corporate world needs right now?
The corporate world needs so much stuff right now. It's not even funny. Like,
I agree with you.
And it's not just the corporate world. It's like every realm of society. So I think, you know, I think we need more critical thinkers in the world. I think we need more people who, you know, can work in collaboration with other people for, you know, to build something larger than they could on their own. I think there's a lot of that. I'm not sure that I think any of the traditional ways that corporations have been run actually work well. I think it's kind of all just like different flavors of like mediocre to fairly terrible. And so I'm super interested in finding different and alternative ways of actually working. You spend so much of your life at work and most of us have to have a job. Like we have, you know, bills to pay and stuff like that. And so why not make that a much better experience for the humans involved? Right. And so I think there's, you know, experimenting with everything, you know, from how you hire to what services you provide to your employees, what types of supports, to how you look at your work and how you engage with your customers and what products you produce. I think all of it is up for experimentation because I don't think any of it, I've never worked in a company where I'm like, oh yeah, they got it right. I'm mostly working in companies where I'm like, oh, let's make it less terrible. and so I think that there's a never ending need to actually find new and better ways to work together, right? Find ways to respect each other, to learn more things all the time, to embrace your customers more closely. Yeah, I just think that there's no, it's all, everything. Everything.
Yeah. I could not agree with you more. I don't know the statistic exactly, but I know that there's like a percentage of people who are literally like in meaningless jobs.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't remember what that percentage is, but it's like they just are sort of like floating along. And so there's so much about our current work world that not only is it not working from like a quote unquote productivity standpoint, but from a purpose standpoint. And leaders are kind of standing there asking why. Like I think that's what we're getting out of this pandemic, which I'm thrilled about, is like we're sort of being confronted with everything that you just said, right? Because people have reevaluated their lives and said like,
I'm not doing this unless it's meaningful. I'm going to go find some place that is.
Yeah. Yeah, one's taken a big step to the right or a step to the left. Like, I know all these people who are changing jobs right now.
Yeah.
Even I did. I took a new job a few months ago.
Exactly. And, yeah. You know, the whole, like, the great resignation of 2021. So my question to you, though, is, so if I'm a leader then, and a leader that you're working with, and I'm kind of standing there feeling helpless, like I'm watching this happen, like people are pouring out of my organization and they're quitting. Or maybe they're not quitting, but they're coming to me and saying, like, I want something different.
Yeah.
What do we say to them? Like, where do we even start?
Just talk to them. Like, what do you want? One of the things when I was coaching at my last company, I did like 50 one-on-ones with people every month. Like, I was coaching like 50 people at various levels, all the way from, you know, leaders to engineers. To random people in marketing and all kinds of places. Talking to people and being curious is really powerful, because if you can build a trusting relationship with someone and actually understand what it is that they're seeking or longing, then you can help co-create that with them. And that's really important. I don't know that people do that a lot. I don't know that people in management positions do that a lot. And there's also a power differential when you're talking to a manager that isn't necessarily present when you're talking to a coach. So, you know, I would say if you're a leader, you know, figure out how genuine your relationships are, or if people are holding back because you can fire them because there is a power differential, and find ways to actually figure out what people are wanting and needing, right? I did a big pivot during the early pandemic days. I went through a coaching program called Positive Intelligence, and I became a positive intelligence coach. And I actually brought that into my last organization and ran a bunch of cohorts of that coaching program. And that was really, really nice, because early pandemic, everyone was super freaked out about everything, right? Mm-hmm. It was a really scary time, and people were not okay, right? And I think there's, in some cases, a reluctance to talk about people not being okay in a corporate setting. But at the same time, you know, there's like are we getting work done? Are we selling things? You know, all these pressures. And it's like, well, okay, but we have people here and they need support and help. So how can we actually support each other and help each other? How can we explore these topics? Because people who are, you know, people who have good mental health are going to be able to do much, much better work, right? It's all connected,
right? Absolutely.
I don't buy into this thing where it's like, oh, like, you know, work and life are separate things. Like they completely influence each other, especially when, you know, suddenly you don't get to go to an office anymore and see people who are in some cases your friends. You have to stay at home, often in your, you know, if you're a younger engineer in a studio apartment, right? People were not okay. So,
no.
You know, I think actually acknowledging that, leaders who can acknowledge that and who can help help their populations move through things like that, those are powerful leaders.
Yeah, I totally agree.
And it starts with figuring out what people need and what people want, and then helping co-create.
Yep. One of the observations I have right now is people are still not okay.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we're not done yet. That's one of the most difficult things. You know, I think that's somewhat global. I think it's obviously worse or better in different areas and different regions, but we're still not okay. And therefore, now leaders have a decision to make, whether conscious or not, about like, how patient are you going to be? You know, like, I think there is this like feeling now that like, okay, well, you know, it's been 18 months and we got to get back to quote unquote normal, even though for 18 months we've been talking about how there's going to be a new normal.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes.
Is that something you were kind of smiling? So is that something that you're seeing as well?
I mean, I think the concept of normal isn't a really great concept, because, I don't know, traditional organizational structures were normal. Hierarchy is normal. having soul-crushing work that you do 8 to 12 hours a day is not kind of normal. And I don't like any of that stuff, right? Mm-hmm. So I think you should never be looking to fall back to what is normal. You should be always looking at, hey, what can and should we be building for the future that's actually better, right? And if the pandemic is something that sparks creativity in people for how to do things differently, then that's, I think, a good thing, right? That's, I'm not looking to get back to normal. I'm looking to get to something that's actually much better.
Yeah, me too. Gosh, I love hearing that from other people, because it's going to take an army of us to, like, you know, continue to reiterate that message. Because I think that companies and leaders were really accepting of that message 6 months into the pandemic, right? Yeah. Because at the moment we were faced with, we cannot be normal. Yeah. Okay. We can't be normal. But with this, like, temptation of going back to normal, I think it's going to take an army of people to continue to reiterate that message. It's going to take podcasts like this one and many, many, many more. So, Elise, if you want to start a podcast, I'll be right there with you. Because otherwise it's too tempting. You know, like, we've all seen, any of us who work in any kind of organizational change, not just Agile, have seen how easy it is to fall back to what you know.
Yeah.
And this isn't just what we know in the work world. I was watching a video the other day about how much school, our regular school systems, and all the respect in the world to teachers, this is not throwing shade at teachers, but is, like, preparing us for sitting at our desks 8 hours a day and doing what we're told, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Like, everything points toward this, not just work.
Yeah. And I had a non-traditional educational path. So I ended up dropping out of high school and going to college when I was 16. I went to a college where the whole freshman class has dropped out of high school and went to college at 16. And so it's a very, it's an interesting situation. It's very non-traditional, and you're suddenly in college classes at the age of 16. Like, some of my classes were 4 people, right? There was no multiple choice tests ever. Right. And it was very illuminating just how broken the educational system is, especially where I grew up in Southern California. And so that was really eye-opening for me. And I think there's actually really exciting things happening in education, especially I went to a college called Simon's Rock, and they're affiliated with Bard, and Bard College started these Bard College early college high school situations in all these high schools on the East Coast, which are giving high school age kids college classes, right? And there's this, there's sort of this mindset of seeking alternatives, even in that educational realm. People can do so much more than they're often given credit for, right? Yeah. I find that you have to hold extremely high expectations for the people that you're working with, and then sometimes they'll meet them, right?
Absolutely.
There's nothing worse than thinking, oh, like, that engineer, they'll never be able to learn that thing. Well, if you say that, then they'll never be able to learn it. But if you say, hey, I know you can learn this thing, let's figure out the steps to do that, they will probably learn that thing, right? So I think it's, like I was saying, like, it's like corporations, I think, are broken. I think school is broken. I think a lot of stuff is less than ideal, and that we should be finding ways, in government, in education, in corporations, how to do things better. Like, there's so much opportunity to do things better. Everyone should be trying to just, redo things.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It gives me hope with, Agile classrooms, the Agile education movement, because it's, then starting really young like that. I mean, I'm struck by your perspective now and how your perspective might have been shaped by that non-traditional experience, because this is another thing I always, I always talk with people when they come on the podcast about what they think a wild heart is.
I'm actually not going to ask you that one, even though I told you I might. I'm going to ask you, how do you think that we're formed? Like, what do you think causes us to see the world differently and not just fall into line?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I feel like even before my college experience, I had a lot of very experimental situations as a kid. I felt like I was sort of a human experiment as a child in all kinds of different ways, from the summer camp that I went to what happened, like the primary education I had, all kinds of stuff. People were trying lots of experiments and I got thrown into a lot of them, sometimes mindfully and sometimes just right place, right time. And so I think that coupled with like my actual just innate personality, like I'm kind of like a burn it all down and build it up again person just by my nature. I think those two things combined helped me to be very, very like non-traditional radical type person. So I think it's not just one thing. I think there's, you know, people are sort of, they're born with different personality traits or different needs. But then there's also, you know, the environmental factors, the family you grew up in, the adults who are close to you when you're a child, and then the institutions that you come in contact with. They all help shape you. But a lot of it's also about how do you experience those things and how do you react to those things? Because we all have, I mean, everyone has a certain amount of trauma in their life. Some people way more than others. But what do you do with that, right? Like, what do you do? How do you process that trauma? And that's one thing I think is very interesting now is that there's a lot more information known about sort of traumatic childhood experiences and how to work with them and how to help people through them. Like, I try to practice trauma-informed work, wherein I try to give people a choice, even if there's no choice. Right. Because giving people choices helps them feel that they have agency. And if they've been traumatized, that helps them like feel, you know, like you're hopefully not re-traumatizing them.
Yeah.
So there's just little things like that about how we work with other humans that I think is really important. And I think, you know, I have a lot of hope for the kids who are coming up today that they get better supports and that hopefully they have better institutions in their lives. And more knowledgeable adults to actually, you know, help them be the people that they want to be.
Yeah, I agree. A little ray of hope. So my daughter has ADHD and has supports for that. But she was just telling us this morning that her teacher came to class in the first week or two and said that essentially what he tries to do is understand the supports that are necessary, you know, that are like required, but then provide them to everyone.
Yeah.
So
yes, why not?
Right. Exactly. Like if I'm going to do it anyway, then like, let me do it for everyone. And he said, because people shouldn't have to jump through hoops like we actually did with her, you know, to receive that kind of support. So if one needs it, others probably need it too, and we just don't know about it. And I was so impressed by that, like just the humanity of that. I wish I knew his name; I'd give him a shout out. But, but the other thing it made me think about really quick. I'm just going to drop a little book reference. I just did a book club for a book called The Four Tendencies. And it's a longer name than that, but I'll drop it in the show notes. But one of the tendencies, or it's kind of like personality profiles, is questioner. Mm-hmm. And you can guess which one that I got, which was the questioner. And so that might be an interesting one if anyone was intrigued by that particular conversation, because it talks a lot about like how you sort of respond to the constraints that you have. And so that might be an interesting book for anybody. For you, Elise, are there any particular books that you're reading right now or podcasts that you'd want to share with the listeners that, you know, are particularly intriguing to you right now?
I am halfway through Brave New Work. I had to put it down. I got interrupted by like three other books, unfortunately.
Is your Goodreads like mine? Like it's constantly like, oh, this one. Nope. This one. There, like yeah, a horse race.
There's like a stack. Yeah. And I've also just started, I finally picked up training from the back of the room because in my new position, I actually have to do quite a bit of training and I don't love training. I actually quite dislike it. So I'm looking for actual better ways to get training done that are more human friendly. So those would be the two books that I'm in the middle of right now.
Amazing. I have Brave New World on my shelf, but I have not read it yet. So
it's good. You should pick it up.
Yeah, I might be right behind you on that one.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, I knew this was going to be a great conversation, even though we were flying blind together. Anything else you want to share with our listeners before we wrap up?
I would just encourage people to just be experimental and try things out. Even if you think it's going to fail, just try it. Like, could it be worse than it is now? Who knows?
Could you be know better. What? I think that is an incredible question because I do get, you know, I get people when I'm encouraging them to experiment and they're like, well, what if this happens? And what if this happens? And I was like, well, what's already happening?
Yeah.
Like, is that better than what you just proposed? So I love that. Yeah. Well, at least, thank you for coming on the show. Thank you for an amazing conversation just about what's possible in the world. I love your spirit. I love your brain.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming. And then for our listeners, thank you for joining us again for another week of Wild Hearts at Work. Like, subscribe, share with your friends. And if you're interested in supporting the show, we now have a Patreon. Just helps with ongoing operational expenses of the podcast, but you can also get a monthly newsletter or merch. It's really weird to think that there's merch, but there is. But again, mostly just thank you for joining us every week. It's been really incredible to see this community grow, and it is an incredible privilege for me to get to talk to such cool people every week. So thank you for being one of them, Elise. And until next time, dear hearts. Stay wild.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Wild Hearts at Work. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and share. For more resources and to connect with Melissa, visit melissaboggs.com. Also, if you or someone you know is doing great work in a wild way, get in touch about being a guest on the show. Until next time.